Hi, welcome to The Final Cut. Here's a question. When is tickling no longer fun?
I mean, obviously it's just for fun.
Is it just for fun? It's tickling.
You know, I was young at the time, didn't think nothing of it. And I was like, $2,000, that's going to be cool.
Today, the New Zealand director who got more than he bargained for when he investigated the shady online world of man-on-man tickling videos.
We could hear laughter coming out of the vents.
Oh my God.
Jason DeRosso with you, RN Film Critic. In a moment, you'll hear more about this bizarre story from director David Ferrier in what is, this week, a show about the mysterious hidden corners of both the internet and the human heart. And we begin with a coming-of-age drama about a Jewish-American boy in the 1950s, Indignation. A warning, there are some sexual references ahead.
I see by your transcript that you're a remarkably gifted student. First in your family ever to attend college. Scholarship from your temple. But under religious preference, I see you didn't write Jewish, though you are of Jewish extraction. I'm wondering why that is.
I don't prefer to practice one religion over another. Praying to me is preposterous.
Is it now? Nonetheless, that is not what we are here to discuss. You're socializing enough?
Yes, I am, sir.
Have you gone on any dates?
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 Yes, I have. One.
Just one?
I want to hear all about your mother. And your father, the butcher, and what it's like working in a butcher shop, and what the girls were like in Newark. Relax.
Based on the 2008 Philip Roth novel, Indignation is a wistful story of first love and tragedy, set at the beginning of the 1950s in the shadow of the Korean War. Marcus, played by Logan Lerman, is the son of a New Jersey Jewish butcher, who is gifted with a precocious intellect, but sexually and emotionally immature. Escaping the draft that has already seen a few boys in the neighbourhood head to the front lines, and some return in coffins, he moves out to a Midwestern university and falls for Olivia, played by Sarah Gaydon, a beautiful blonde Gentile from an establishment family whose forward attitudes to sex are a revelation that both shocks and bewilders him. It's hard to think of a first-time director with a longer or more impressive career than James Shamus, a producing and writing collaborator of the Taiwanese Hollywood director Ang Lee, with screenwriting credits including The Ice Storm and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. He's also founder of Universal's arthouse division Focus Features, not to mention a film scholar who's taught at Columbia University and published a book on Drea. At 58 years old, you might wonder if there's a reason he hasn't made a film earlier. But thankfully, Indignation has none of the ostentatious flourishes or unevenness of a later life crisis vanity project. It's a considered, well-cast drama, relatively unburdened by exposition, even though it rests on a handful of key conversation scenes. Shamus knows that a simple visual vocabulary of wides and close-ups, when edited with the right rhythm positioned from the correct angle, can yield as effective results as a complicated tracking shot. The story's power is in its commitment to Marcus's point of view, so that his shocks reverberate through us. Olivia, of course, is the centre of his emotional upheaval. In Marcus's eyes, she's a mesmerizing ideal of sex appeal and sophistication. But he fails to truly see her, and no amount of Bertrand Russell or determined reasoning can help him decipher her emotional layers or erratic moods. Nor is he prepared for the power of their first intimate encounters, the awkward introduction to oral sex on the cold leather seats of a friend's car, or the hand jobs in a hospital bed while recovering from appendicitis. The adults in his world sense his immaturity. The dean of the university, played by Tracy Letts, tries to bully him into line. His father, played by Danny Bernstein, pleads and cajoles. And his mother, Linda Emmond, delivers an ultimatum. She's a vividly drawn counterpoint to Olivia, and she reminded me of something I read in a profile of Philip Roth about how When the writer was born in 1933, Jews were still not allowed into some country clubs. Marcus's mother is not the pearl-clutching WASP matriarch. She represents a generation of American Jews for whom the desperation and racism of the migrant experience were still very real. For people like her, a disciplined, pragmatic attitude to life was like a suit of armour. As she and Olivia inevitably struggle over Marcus, the film's melancholy observation is that the world spins too fast sometimes, even for prudent people like her. It's a terrible revelation in a way, but it's explored with a touching, generous intuitiveness. Here's James Seamus talking first about obtaining the rights to Indignation, the novel.
For us, it wasn't that hard, quite frankly. He and his fiercely protective agent were very helpful to us every step of the way. So, boring answer, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I wish I could claim that I, you know, drove up to his home in Connecticut and serenaded him from beneath the window that he looks out from as he writes at his standing table, but that was not the case.
Standing table, like Walter Murch editing standing up. Well, so many of us are doing that nowadays.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a long time. Before it was hip, he was doing it.
Tell me, have you met him?
I have indeed.
And has he seen the film?
Yeah, you know, Philip Roth in this movie, as with all things Philip Roth, a bit complicated. We obtained the rights to the film, and a bit before pre-production started, I did something very stupid, which I didn't have to do because I had the right to proceed with the movie since we had set the check. And that was, I sent him the screenplay. And if he had really hated the screenplay, I probably would have called off the entire production. Lucky for me, he did me an enormous favor. And that is, he refused to read the script. And that refusal was certainly a gift. It freed me up, as I know he knew it would, to do what I needed to do, to make the film. And then after we completed the film, we were in post-production, we did screen it for him, and we were blessed. He really responded extremely well to it.
Well, I think he's right to approve it. I mean, I found it a very affecting film, and I don't know if people have expressed this to you before, but it rises above the sum of its parts. In some ways, the characters, especially the two young characters who are, well, let's call them in love, even though that's not really an adequate description. You know, if I was to analyze exactly what makes both of them tick and so forth, they're both very enigmatic. You might even say that on paper, you know, in terms of the screenplay, they were thinly drawn. And yet the sort of magic of this wonderfully simple cinematic telling of their story is just filled with so much nuance.
Yeah, well, no, thank you for that observation, because it is important to me that, at least in my own screenplays, both for this film and for the ones I've done for people like Ang Lee, I make it a point to underwrite by current standards. And those are standards both for what gets put on the page, but also for what gets told explicitly to the audience about character motivation and background, and explaining everything. And I'm like, you know, guys and gals and everybody on the whatever spectrum you're on, you know, when you walk into a room and you see somebody who intrigues you and attracts you and makes you want to spend time with them, it's not as if you have already Googled them and gotten into their OkCupid file and looked at all 300 questions that they answered and know everything about them and their relationship with their mothers. Far from it. In real life, I think those kinds of attractions and interests are spurred by a certain sense of mystery. And I wanted to have the respect both for my characters and for my audience to allow for some of that mystery to remain far after the film ended.
It's interesting seeing the sort of, I like the depiction of the fumbling sexuality in this film. And I don't think we ever see, we don't ever see a conventional love scene, or a love scene that in conventional terms, you know, could be described as romantic. There's, I mean, basically to use vulgar terminology, there are quite a few hand jobs in the film. I mean, it's really kind of fumbling, late teen, 1950s repressed sexuality on display here. How did you feel about approaching a story with this kind of sexual tone to it? Was that a challenge?
No, weirdly enough, I seem to have a predilection for really bad sex scenes in the sense scenes are about bad sex. Not bad sex, but they're not, it's not standard Hollywood, the orchestra is about to swell and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this goes back to the Ice Storm that I wrote, produced for Ang Lee.
Sure.
Where I really, you know, threw down the gauntlet for Ang on, like, this is really going to be the worst sex scene ever. And I think we achieved that. I think we've, you know, we have our place in cinema history there. But for me, you know, the sex scenes in this movie are kind of like the fight scenes in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. They're narrative, right? They're like, they're part of the storytelling, and I don't mean that in that silly way where people say things like, I'll do nudity if it advances the story. In this case, they open up this kind of almost like an abyss, emotional and narrative abyss for our characters that they can't figure out, they can't get away from. You know, that desire just pops up, and it then reconfigures what they think is their ability to control their world, and obviously they can't. And for Logan Lerman's character, it's just this moment of absolute disconnect between everything you've been told and taught and everything you repressed, and now everything you feel but you can't articulate. And for Olivia Hutton, the character Olivia Hutton, played by Sarah Gadon, it's something much different, and it's more disturbing and more profound in ways. She's exercising at least a momentary sense of control, right, over this guy. And I think it's an expression of a need to have that sense of approval and have that sense of control at the same time. But at the same time, as I explained to Sarah Gadon when we were shooting the first what was such scene in the cemetery, she has a little smile on her face at the end of it, right? But I said, that's a Pyrrhic victory. You know, this is not a victory that will last that long. And sure enough, about 30 seconds later in the film, you see that smile very much transformed into something else.
James Shamus, director of the very moving drama Indignation, which is out now. On RN, you're listening to The Final Cut.
I've made a career out of looking at the weird and bizarre side of life.
It's quite a kick.
So when I discovered a strange video online, I knew I'd found my next story.
CET, Competitive Endurance Tickling Group we got here.
Competitive Endurance Tickling. It was one of the strangest sports I'd seen. So I told Jane O'Brien Media I'd like to do an interview. Instead of getting a yes or no, I got this.
Association with a homosexual journalist is not something we will embrace.
Shame on you, little gay Kiwis. Regards, Jane O'Brien Media.
It was hard to take the insult seriously, considering the sport did seem slightly gay.
This is the strangest story you will encounter all week. Just a couple of years ago, a New Zealand TV reporter named David Farrier, specialising in stories about pop culture and human interest oddities, came across some online videos showing groups of young, muscular men in sports gear tickling each other. Despite the obvious homoerotic overtones, the videos purported to depict a sport known as competitive endurance tickling, though David could find no evidence of its real-world existence. Upon making a few inquiries to the company behind the footage, Jane O'Brien Media, he began receiving hostile threats of legal action laced with homophobic language. And then there was a visit from three American men who have flown first class to New Zealand to discourage him from digging further. All of this happens in the first 10 minutes of Tickled, a jaw-droppingly compelling film. Part of the attraction is that Tickled arouses our deepest suspicions of the internet as a place that's not some ordered mirror image of the streets and suburbs of our physical world, but a vague and sinister topography in whose dark corners people congregate to indulge in behaviour and fantasies considered taboo in real life. David and his cameraman friend Dylan head to the US where they encounter further mysteries and threats, as well as some surprising leads. To say any more would spoil it. Tickled is highly entertaining and a surprisingly thought-provoking film in the end about power, greed, and the distorting lens of the web. Here's David Farrier.
It escalated really slowly. So I got that initial response on Facebook from Jane O'Brien Media, you know, who produced these tickling videos saying, you know, we don't want to deal with a homosexual journalist. That was the first time where my ears pricked up and I went, okay, there's more going on here than some company making tickling videos. You know, that kind of response was so intense.
At what point did you get scared? I mean, very early in the film, we see three men come out, representatives of this media company, the Jane O'Brien Media Company. One of them instantly takes umbrage at the fact that you have someone on a camera rolling as they come out of the arrivals lounge. So instantly we're thinking they're on edge. But at what point do you start to get a little scared of these men?
I mean, I was apprehensive, you know, even before they came to New Zealand, when they, you know, they had a private investigator turn up at my house and I was at work and they called me at on my cell phone and saying, I'm outside your house, I've got something to give you. And, you know, I just said, you know, leave in the letterbox and get out, you know, get off my property. And, you know, they delivered a sort of a cease and desist letter from a New York attorney, and then they hired the American attorney and a New Zealand attorney sort of telling me to stop. So I was apprehensive and sort of somewhat scared from that point of view because the legal threats were coming in. But, you know, when they said they were going to send three people to New Zealand, that just took things up a notch. And I think it's about that point that I really knew that, you know, me and my friend Dylan, who made this film with me, you know, we had a film. I mean, they were actually sending the talent all the way over to us in New Zealand. So, I mean, it would be kind of criminal if we didn't start filming at that point.
Yeah. I mean, there are levels beyond these men. I'm not giving anything away here, but there are levels even beyond these three guys that come out.
Yeah, I mean, we knew once. I mean, their whole message was, you know, if you pursue this story, you will be financially ruined, and also there's nothing to see here. So of course, when someone tells you that, as a journalist, obviously you go, there's definitely more going on. So, you know, Dylan and I went to America and we started interviewing some of the young men that had taken part in the tickling competition. And we started finding out that some of those men had been subjected to exactly the same harassment that Dylan and I were being subjected to, the legal threats, the sort of insane insults. Plus, you know, a lot of these young men, they were having websites made up about them with all their personal details spread all over the web. So we sort of went on this road trip to try and find out who Jane O'Brien Media was. And yeah, things got more and more intense. And we kind of uncovered this story that, you know, stretched back, well, over 20 years. So things got way more intense and way darker than we imagined, you know, when I found this innocent tickling video.
Well, it's interesting. What comes also to mind as you're watching the film is, I mean, what is this? A shell company for the mafia or something, you know, given the underworld's links with porn and, you know, it's really unclear. And various people are telling you at various times to back off. Was there ever a point where you thought we need to make some contingency plans? I mean, if these people get violent?
Yeah, we were very aware throughout making the whole film about, you know, any kind of physical dangers, you know, in any kind of anything that sort of crossed over into the physical realm. So, you know, when we premiered at Sundance, you know, film festivals are very wary when there's a film that is controversial. And so we had members of Jane O'Brien Media turn up at our premiere at Sundance. Sorry, not our premiere. It was our second screening at Sundance. And so, you know, security, they called in the police. They were on standby because we don't know how these people are going to react. You know, we were very careful the whole way through. And, you know, we're all fine. I'm fine. Dylan's fine. But I think when you're making a film about a company that clearly doesn't want a film made about them, and you're being told that when you go to the United States to follow them, there won't be a moment where a private investigator isn't following you, then, you know, you just keep looking over your shoulder. And I still feel like I'm doing that at the moment because, you know, that we've had screenings in the United States and various other places where, you know, these people turn up and they often like yelling at us.
It reminded me a bit of, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to tell you this, but the film about the mediated romance, the online sort of romance that became Catfish with
yes.
A very strange twist at the end. Something about the internet, I feel, and long distance or, you know, mediated sort of relationships that just has a particular mysterious aura about it and a sinister aura about it.
No, well, the internet is a really big character in the story, and, you know, it's sort of the internet and behaviors on the internet spanning sort of since it was born, you know. So, I mean, this whole story starts in the days of, you know, AOL Instant Messenger and RealPlayer and, you know, all this sort of, all the stuff that was around when the internet first started in a, you know, in a mainstream kind of a way. So, yeah, I mean, I think the catfish comparison is fair. It's like, I think there's sort of like catfish, but with a hell of a lot more money involved. And, you know, as soon as you get the internet, I mean, part of the joy of the internet is freedom. And it's just unfortunate that some people use that freedom in a slightly darker way by hiding behind different personas and being dishonest. And, you know, ultimately, this is a story sort of less about tickling and more about one company's need to have, you know, power and control over people that it sort of sucks into this crazy kind of tickling empire. So, the catfish comparison.
I laugh, but it's actually not funny, is it? As it starts to unfold, it becomes incredibly sinister, and there are all these sorts of, I don't know, resonances with very sinister aspects of the web, like the deep web or...
Yeah, and I think, you know, it ends up, you know, we end up dealing... You know, this company does have a lot of money. You know, they've got the money to, you know, people are being paid thousands of dollars to tickle each other. They're being flown from all around the world to America to tickle, and it's happening a lot. And so the money involved is huge, and... You know, we find out that a lot of people involved in the company aren't who they say they are. And, you know, it's not a story about tickling. It's not a story about a wacky tickling competition. It's about, especially in the United States, how it's possible for a company or, you know, even an individual to be sheltered by money and to have an incredible amount of leeway with that. And, you know, we end up sort of telling a story about how, you know, with money comes power and control, and also, in a way, a way to escape any kind of justice, it seems. And I think it's something that we see, you know, at the moment you've got a man in America who could be president who is untruthful and has a penchant for suing people, and he is hugely popular over there, and America supports that. You know, America supports Donald Trump, which is incredibly odd and strange, but I think we find similarities in the people that we follow in this film where, you know, if you've got money, you've got control and you have power, and that can be quite a terrifying prospect, I think.
Yes, and it is very apt that your film finds the victims of this international tickling conspiracy, online tickling conspiracy, and finds them to be impoverished people, more or less. I mean, they're all people in need of money. So you've kind of got two extremes. It really is an interesting insight into a bizarre embodiment, I suppose, of American capitalism, where you've got two extremes coming together via this weird fetish.
Yeah, it's a very parasitic relationship. And, you know, right from the get-go, the young men, as you said, that are drawn into competitive endurance tickling, they're in it for the money, and they don't have money. They're poor. And they're immediately when they're sucked into this world, they do not have the upper hand. You know, they're dealing with a company with almost unlimited resources, and they don't realize it at the time, but that is going to come back and get them. It's not like you're dealing with, you know, a bunch of wealthy people backed by lawyers going into this sport. It is a bunch of incredibly poor people from America and all around the world who are just trying to get a break. And that is later, that is used against them in the worst possible way.
David Farrier, his film Tickled is out this week. And that's just about it for the show today. But if neither film tickled your fancy, I can also recommend briefly the shark attack thriller The Shallows, in which a very skimpy bikini-clad Blake Lively cowers bruised and bloody on a rock 20 metres from an idyllic Mexican beach as she's circled by the hungriest shark in the ocean, judging from how many surfers it eats in the space of one day and one night. The Shallows is well worth checking out, more than a serviceable thriller from Spanish director Jaume Colette Serra. If you're in Sydney too, check out the drollness that's on display at the ongoing Hong Sang-soo retrospective at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And for more film discussion here on RN, do track down Books and Arts Daily's analysis of the adaptation of J.G. Ballard's dystopian novel High Rise. This has been The Final Cut. I'm Jason DeRosso. I'll see you next time.
I'm not dying here.